Hello and welcome to the SIUC Farm Advisory Service podcast, which is part of the Arable Scotland 2020 event, which I'm hoping you will all join us online for on the 2nd of July. This afternoon, we're going to be talking with just a few people from SIUC who have presentations which are going to be part of Arable Scotland 2020, which you're all invited to go and to view. But this afternoon, we're really just going to be talking about things in general which are related to their presentations at the webinars, and there'll be a question and answer session for us between us, having a group discussion later on after everybody's had a brief opportunity to talk about what they're going to be presenting at Arable Scotland. So we have Neil Havis, who's from SIUC, Robin Walker, Fiona Burnett and Henry Cryson. So we'd like to start off by asking Neil Havis just to give us an overview of some of the things he's going to be talking about at the Arable Scotland event.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Andy, for the introduction. So at the Arable Scotland event, I was really going to be covering a number of topics. Primarily, we was going to talk about ramularia leaf spot and barley. So as you're probably all aware, ramularia leaf spot has become an increasing problem in barley crops. We've seen it on the increase over the last 20 years. We have no resistant varieties to speak of. So our control has relied almost exclusively on the use of chemistry. And the major part of your control strategy for ramularia leaf spot has been chlorothalonil. And as everybody's aware, from the 20th of May, it was no longer approved for use on barley crops. So that's presented a challenge for barley growers. How do we manage ramularia leaf spot in the absence of chlorothalonil? There are some projects and experiments we have running. So we've been looking at existing chemistry to see how it's doing against ramularia. In 2017, we saw the complete collapse of control from the SDHI and azole fungicides. But 2018 and that very hot summer seems to have affected the pathogen population. So in a way, we've gone back to a slightly more sensitive population, which means in 2019, we did see some activity from prothioconazole and some of the SDHI fungicides against ramularia. So if you think ramularia is going to be an issue for you, you can consider prothioconazole. The other thing that we all have new in 2020, of course, is the new azole from BASF, methotrexate, or Revisol as it's called. So that could be an option, but that had to be used up to growth stage 45 on a malting crop. So in terms of other multi-sites, people are interested in the potential of Fulpit. And we know from our trials, Fulpit has shown only a little activity against ramularia leaf spot. In Scotland, in other countries, for example, Ireland, it's shown more promising results. So again, that's one option that farmers have to consider. In terms of the season, it's not really been an ideal season. I would expect to see much ramularia leaf spot, having had two of the wettest months on record, followed by two of the driest. Those are not really the conditions that the fungus enjoys. So at the moment, the winter barley crops that we have in our trials look fairly clean. Big question mark, I suppose, will be the spring barley crops. But again, they've been grown in those very dry conditions. We've seen crops accelerate through the growth stages and they look very clean and almost disease-free. So I would not expect to see a high ramularia pressure this year.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Neil. We'll have some questions for you a bit later on. But now I'd like to ask Henry Cryson to talk about what he's going to be presenting, as it were, at the Arable Scotland event, particularly from an integrated pest management perspective.
Thanks, Andy. So I'm Henry Cryson, an applied plant pathologist at Scotland's Royal College. And at Arable Scotland, I'll be talking about some of the work we've done measuring and quantifying adoption of IPM practices on arable farms in the UK. And I'll also be discussing some of the integrated disease management trials we have in winter barley. So integrated pest management is a holistic approach to managing harmful organisms that maximises profitability whilst minimising negative impacts on the environment. The problem is that until now, our ability to practically monitor and measure IPM adoption across arable farms is limited. This is due to the wide range of practices that can be regarded as IPM. So our aim was to establish a universal metric to quantify adoption levels on arable farms in Scotland. To do so, we conducted a farmer survey of over 200 farmers around the UK and Ireland. We asked questions related to adoption of specific IPM practices. We asked questions related to perception of IPM. And we also asked some socioeconomic questions on the farmer and the farm business to allow us to delve deeper and just identify some of the drivers and constraints to further IPM adoption. We then set about constructing a metric, which involved a lot of stakeholder interaction. And so we had farmers, agronomists, researchers, policymakers, merchants, all involved in this process. And the sum total of the 50 odd responses we had gave us our final IPM metric, which is on a 0 to 100 scale. What we found is that those farmers in Scotland and England had achieved higher levels of IPM adoption than those in Northern Ireland or Ireland. We also found that farm area was associated with a higher level of uptake. This could be due to an increased capacity to handle risks associated with changes in practice, an increased capacity to rotate crops, having more fields and more machinery to cultivate other crops. It could also be due to them having a greater workforce on hand to conduct some of the intensive monitoring of pest and disease and weed levels in the fields. They're also more likely to employ an independent agronomist and seek independent advice, as well as having a designated farm manager. In addition to farm area, we also found that those high adopters of IPM placed a greater importance on the significance of biological control measures. Perhaps most importantly, we found that farmers' self-assessed familiarity with IPM was associated with an increase in adoption of such practices. This is not really surprising because if farmers are going to adopt more IPM practices, they first must acquire the knowledge to confidently implement those changes towards greater IPM adoption. We found that those who have a better working relationship with their advisor, they employ an advisor and rely on them and act on their advice, also had a higher IPM score. What we did find is that information source is key, and those attending farm walks, open days, and discussion groups are much more likely to be familiar with IPM and as a result adopt IPM to a higher level. Those high scorers were also more likely to value an independent agronomist over a merchant agronomist. It must be pointed out that actually we didn't assess the quality of the advice from the different information sources. What we are reporting are just the most valued information sources for those high adopters and those lower adopters of IPM. In summary, we find that the results show that actively seeking current IPM advice results in changes towards greater IPM adoption. However, for these changes to be successful, they must be based on up-to-date, evidence-based advice. This is why we conduct field trials, looking at how the various components of IPM, from rotation to variety to selection, monitoring, record keeping, and fungicide spraying, can interact to ultimately maintain or improve yields whilst simultaneously reducing our reliance on synthetic fungicides. Trials that we have on show today in winter barley look at the interaction between variety and fungicides on disease levels and, as a result, fungicide requirements. We're looking at different varieties ranging in susceptibility to the most important diseases of barley in Scotland, such as Rhynchosporium and Netboch. And we're also looking at how mixtures of varieties can be used to buffer against such stresses and maintain yield across sites and over years. We found that actually over the last 2 years, even though disease pressure has been quite low, those mixtures that we designed to actually provide a better yield under high disease pressure are still attaining similar levels of grain yield to those highest yielding monocultures. We're also looking at the interaction between variety and fertilizer additions. These Lawson Trust funded trials we have shown that those plots receiving the majority of their nitrogen at the start of stem extension had greater green leaf area later in the season, and this translated to a greater yield compared to those who received the majority of the nitrogen at mid-tillering. We also have a trial looking at the effect of sowing date and variety on fungicide requirement and yields. And these are entering their third year of these RESAS funded trials at our Bog Hall site in Edinburgh.
Thanks very much for that, Henry. A lot of stuff there, which you can get more information from the webinars, which are going to be on the Arable Scotland event. Next, I'd like to ask Robin Walker, who's going to talk a bit about alternative crops and particularly legumes in terms of how they can help contribute to the rotations within arable cropping in Scotland.
Hello, so my name is Robin Walker and I'm a researcher based at Crabston in Aberdeen. So one of the things I'm going to be talking about is some break crop options, particularly looking at mixtures and protein crops, and most of these have got a leguminous element to them. So the work that I've been doing with a range of colleagues on leguminous break crops, really we've been investigating a range of protein crops and forage crops or forage legumes with prospects for reliable production. And we've really been looking, although I'm based in the northeast of Scotland, we've got colleagues who are looking in the central parts of the country, as well as in the southwest, particularly in the dairying areas. So one of the key things we're looking at is potential options for livestock, but also human end uses. And the other reason we're looking into these is really to try and reduce the reliance on imported soya. So really, can you grow it on your own farm, or can it be grown on farms locally? So the work that we're doing is at a range of scales. So the small plot type scales that you would typically see at the Arable Scotland event. But we've also got work on larger plots, and we've also got a number of participatory pieces of work looking at these types of crops on farms. So we've got groups of farms who are growing some of these, particularly in a project called Remix, an EU project called Remix, where they're growing a range of legume and either cereal or sort of herb type crops on their farms. So as I said, there's a range of legumes and forage species that we're looking at, and we're really looking at how we can incorporate those into this cropping system. So whether it's a more diverse rotation, or whether within that rotation in a particular year, we're looking at crop mixtures or intercrops, often with a leguminous link. So in terms of the grain crops, something that people may be familiar with is things like peas and spring barley as a mix. So we're testing those either in mixtures or in sole crops, and we're looking at different sowing rates. And we're also interested in lupins as well, because the amino acid profile of those that crop is actually fairly similar to soya. So if you can grow that effectively, that's great. Other things that people are maybe more familiar with are spring beans. So we're looking at those again as a sole crop or an intercrop. And we have tried growing soya for a couple of years using some varieties that we got from colleagues in Sweden, but we didn't have a huge amount of success. So there's probably a fair bit of breeding required before we can grow them in our kind of northern climate. The other slightly more exotic set of species that we've looked at We've tried sort of red lentils and the canapui or the green lentils. So we've grown those for a few years, and we've got some plots in the Arable Scotland site of the green type of variety called Anisia. And again, we typically grow that with a scaffold. So we're using a spring oat scaffold to hold the lentils up, because otherwise they have a tendency to go flat. So we have actually grown them successfully through to grain harvest. But all of the crops that I've just mentioned, because we've got, inclement weather, we're also looking at opportunities to maybe harvest at an earlier stage as a whole crop. So we're really looking at alternative methods of harvest so that at least you can get a protein crop in there, plus the other benefits associated with the legumes themselves. So, yep, we aim to combine these at the end of the season for grain, but we're also prepared to kind of look at how the season's panning out and make a harvest earlier on and sile it or preserve it in some way. So the other work that we're interested in is things like diverse sort of herbal lays. So we've got a number of plots which have a very, very diverse range of species in there, up to 18. And again, there's a large legume component there. This is predominantly aimed at sheep and cattle. But some of the work that we're doing with other organisations, for example, the Rowett, and other colleagues within SRUC, there's an opportunity to try and extract the protein from the green material that we have. So we're very interested in growing large amounts of biomass, but with a high protein content that isn't necessarily fed directly, but can be processed in some way. And then the protein from that can be utilized for products later in the down the cycle. So we have grown, as I say, lentils successfully twice through to grain. Of the mixtures that I mentioned, the most successful one is probably the pea and barley. That's the most consistent. And we tended to use a slightly higher proportion of pea to barley because, again, we're aiming for the protein. So some of the farmers in our participatory work had the other way around, so they had slightly less pea, a slightly lower ratio of pea to the cereal, or the spring barley in this case. But we found that it actually worked particularly well with a slightly higher pea ratio. We have grown the peas and the beans and lupins successfully on their own as a sole crop, but they're much more variable. So having the intercrop actually can be quite beneficial in terms of being there or thereabouts most years in terms of yield. So the other reason we're interested in growing these things is to try and improve things like the soil health, whether that's the physical health in terms of soil structure, things like chemical health. So obviously there's a nitrogen fixing element associated with the legumes, and also the biological health. So obviously the rhizobia on the roots, root nodules for nitrogen fixation, but also to try and stimulate some of the microbial processes that go on in terms of a healthy soil and nutrient cycling and turnover. We're also interested in the use of reducing agrochemical use. So some of this ties in with some of the things that Henry was talking about in terms of IPM and an opportunity to reduce products. And obviously the other thing is these are usually flowering plants, so we've got work where we're looking at the benefits in terms of pollinators. So we've actually designed some of the mixtures to have a broad appeal to a range of insects in particular. So we've looked at the typical things like the clovers, the whites, the reds, crimson clovers a bit more unusual, and trefoils, these kind of things in terms of the forage crops. And I've already mentioned the grain legumes, the kind of the peas, the lupins, beans, and the lentils as well that we're investigating. And again, it's not just a case of growing them in one particular year. We're also interested in the carryover effect in terms of the other public goods, so system productivity over time. So one of the things is mentioned is the soil improvements. We've got the nitrogen fixing of the legumes as well. And again, in some of the work that we've done with undersown cereals, where we've grown white clover undersown in the cereal, you're still seeing benefits to the following two or at least 3 year crops. So some of the research work we've done in the past has kind of shown that this longevity impact. So although you might be looking at a gross margin, the particular year that you're growing these crops, it's actually quite important to maybe just take into account that actually there are still going to be some financial benefits in the terms of the carryover effect of them later down the line.
We also have Fiona Burnett from SIUC, who will tell us a bit more about the Arable Scotland 2020 event and also about some of the challenges that growers are now facing.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks for the introduction there. Yes, I'm Fiona Burnett. So I head knowledge exchange and collaborations at SRUC, but I also head up the agricultural sector for the Plant Health Centre in Scotland. And really for the Arable Scotland event, we'll be thinking particularly about, you know, the necessity for sustainable practices in plant health. So we're struggling with our crops in Scotland with this backdrop of high disease pressure. We know we have very high yielding crops, but the yield drag created by the amount of disease that we get in our wet climate is a real feature. And that's sitting against a backdrop of fungicide resistance and pesticide withdrawals. So what we'll be looking at the Arable Scotland event is comparing our experiences of introducing best practice in our arable crops with that in New Zealand, which I think will be interesting, where they have similar problems and disease burdens, but a different range of chemistry. And they've been dealing, they've coped without chlorothalonil for a long time. So they have more experience than us in managing that risk. So that is the kind of backdrop of the issues that we're dealing with and the, you know, the need to pick up more integrated practices. And I think, you know, Neil's spoken about, you know, the pressures on the barley crop. The pressures on the wheat crop are similar. And that, you know, feature of losing chlorothalonil has been a major issue. We've got some new chemistry arriving, which is good, not as much as we're losing. So Neil mentioned the new azole Revisol, which again is improving efficacy in the wheat crop, where we've had this erosion of the azole efficacy in Septoria. We've got the new Inatrek product, so a genuinely new product that introduces the chance to mix and match our chemistry and, you know, steward against resistance a bit better. And then coming behind that new chemistry, which we've seen do well in our wheat trials, are products like Adepidin, which is in the SDHI group, the one that we already know we have to manage carefully. And we have what are being referred to as second generation strobilurins or QOIs. So strobilurin type chemistry that seems to be effective against pathogens like Septoria, which carry the G143E mutation. And the really big issue that growers have been dealing with this year has been the loss of chlorothalonil, where we know that it's important in terms of efficacy. It has been important. We've clearly lost it now. And it's the benefit of using other multi-sites in wheat programmes to steward against resistance and to support the efficacy of the other chemistry. So for me, wheat is a crop where we have sufficient resistance issues emerging in our current chemistry and enough of an incentive to protect the new stuff coming, that the use of these low-risk multi-sites like Folpet and Mancozeb adds to the stewardship in that context. Neil discussed them in the context of the barley crop, and there, because we have a slightly broader base of effective chemistry still, the need and what they add is probably less in that crop. But I think the case for using multi-sites in wheat to support the other chemistry is really quite strong. This has clearly been a very difficult season for growing arable crops. We had that very wet autumn followed by a very dry spring. And that uncertainty about the level of disease and the pressure in crops is one of the reasons why we're not always as good as we could be at using the tools available. So we know that it's great we're picking up more resistant varieties of wheat, but actually the fungicide programmes are not particularly adjusted to suit that risk. And we've got a series of work with the HDB and other partners, you know, ADAS, Truggis and NIAB, where we're looking at the risks attached to different wheat varieties in different disease scenarios, so early drilled versus late drilled. And our site is kind of typical of the other sites, that where you have a susceptible variety in a high-risk early drilled situation, you get big responses to high-dose fungicide programs, you know, almost 2 tons averaging out over the trials. If you take that down to the, a resistant variety in a late drilled scenario, the increments in moving up the programs are much less. And we really can see that you can reduce the fungicide inputs in a very low-risk way, where you look at those scenarios. Now, clearly, this wasn't a year where you would have deliberately late drilled, but that is a scenario that we're very familiar with, and we know that these late drilled crops carry a lower risk of disease and can be treated slightly differently. So really, to conclude, that, I mean, I think the key features going forward are going to be how we cope in a post-chlorothalonil world. And that use of the other multi-sites is really important, as is moving on to some of the newer, more effective chemistry and not relying on the, you know, the fading glories of what we had. And I think another sort of key message is definitely the use of resistant varieties is one of our safe spaces, one of our really good tools. But alternative crops, which is one of the themes at Arable Scotland, is another key piece in reducing the disease pressure over rotations, particularly the stem base and trash borne diseases. So it really is about keeping all the tools together and using more resistant varieties like Skyfall as an example of a sectorial resistant wheat variety, using that to advantage and being able to reduce our input programs and really moving forward and picking up the win-wins in, you know, integrated and continue to support our, you know, successful arable production, but reduce the pressures on pesticide chemistry.
Right, thanks very much for that, Fiona. We'll just have a bit of a sort of Q&A session with the people that you've just heard from. And I'd like to start off by asking Neil a question, really, about what are the sort of things that growers can do about the varieties and the inputs that are going to be going on, say, this autumn to try and minimise any risks from diseases? You know, I suppose what I'm hinting at is, like, you know, any varieties that might have good resistance to ramularia, that sort of thing.
I think, as I mentioned earlier on, one of the troubles we have with ramularia is the lack of consistently and effective resistance in the barley varieties currently on the recommended list. So HDB did fund some work where we did score some varieties last year, but what we're really finding is that there's no standout in terms of resistance. The kind of resistance levels that we do see are pretty much, if you think about the old resistance ratings, they're all about similar levels, so maybe sixes and sevens. There are no nines and there are no threes on the recommended list. So in terms of planning your crop management, you really don't put anything in the box for resistance from the variety. You still have to think about other aspects, and you'll see more in some of the things I talked about on the podcast for Arable Scotland, some of the other factors that can influence ramularia, and that can be how close you sow your crop. So if it's a winter barley crop following a spring barley crop and there's lots of ramularia, there is a potential for the green bridge effect.
So related to that, really, this is a question for Henry about, on a broader kind of brush approach to IPM, what are the sort of win-wins that growers could maybe think about doing to try and, I suppose, up their IPM score or their IPM metric?
Sure. Well, one of the main things would be to seek independent advice. We do find that having a good relationship with the agronomist and acting on their advice and actively seeking new advice and engaging in knowledge transfer events is going to, overall, it should lead to an increase in IPM adoption and an IPM score. Some of the things we can be thinking about for the win-wins are pretty fundamental in that you're selecting varieties based on disease resistance traits that are related to the diseases of threat in your area. Carefully monitoring the crop and adjusting sowing dates according to the developmental rate of the crop, but also which diseases are present and also local and regional information on the diseases that are present should allow you to adjust your fungicide program and get the most profit from your fungicide inputs.
Yeah, so good points there, Henry. And I think that piece about we can use the tools that we've got in hand at the moment. So you'll know when crops are drilled, in succession, monitoring crops and reacting to what you see, both in terms of what builds up from this autumn, but also, you know, as the crop develops. And that's a really key piece, as is building in any of the other intelligence that you can add. So it could be very simple things like being aware of the weather, or it can be moving on to some of the more innovative things. So using some of the apps that let you, you know, really look at the local weather situation. And some of these new tools, I think, will be quite exciting going forward. But I'm really anxious that we don't use the sort of promise of new technology to delay taking action now. So there are quite simple things we can do to make the most of our existing chemistry, avoid overexposing it. It's not an either or. We can add on the new innovations. And again, some of those we discussed at the Arable Scotland event, we can add these on to our existing tools. But at the moment, we can make far better use of, you know, the existing tools we've got, like varietal resistance. And I was talking earlier about wheat varieties, but, you know, going forward into this autumn, if we could, you know, move away from things like elation, where the Septoria score is down at 4.3, and move up to the, you know, the fireflies, the skyfalls, where we're looking at a 7, that's a much better position to be in. And there are uncertainties around that. We know the yellow rust position is moving about, but again, staying on top of, you know, the intelligence about what the new races are will be really key in how you react to what's there. And again, things like taking out the fungicide timings that we know don't really respond, that's just a really simple way of moving to a more integrated practice. So we know that autumn fungicides add very little to yield and they don't persist and do much in terms of managing the disease either. So they're very easy to take these marginal ones out of the programmes going forward.
Robin, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I was just going to say that although most of the kind of mixture work or intercrop work that I'd talked about had a large legume component in it. I know some of the work that Henry's done in the past has looked at mixtures of cereal species, for example, in terms of disease control. I know there are issues, or there can be issues in terms of selling a crop that's based on a mixture of varieties, but that's certainly one of the methods I would have thought that could or is relevant in terms of the IPM and disease control.
Do you want to add something to that, Henry?
Sure. I mean, this is why we've been doing the varietal mixture studies in winter barley. So we're aiming at producing a feed crop under low fungicide inputs. So that's sort of circumnavigate some of the issues we might have with heterogeneity of the grain at the end of the season. Those trials that we do have are entering their third year now, and they've been conducted in Aberdeen and Lanarkshire. And even though we've not had a lot of disease at either site really in those past 2 years, the mixtures are performing in terms of yield around about the same as the best performing monocultures. So that does bode well in that even in the absence of disease, they're still yielding well. It's potentially the situation that in a higher pressure year where there's a lot more disease about, the benefits of the mixture will be more evident. But this really sort of gets back to a lot of the questions that we're trying to answer with regards to IPM. We're looking at the individual building blocks of IPM and their relative value in isolation and in combination, but it's also about understanding under what circumstances you're likely to see the benefits of those IPM components. So particularly under what levels of disease pressure, under what weather conditions, what position in the rotation, for example, are you likely to see the benefits of introducing a varietal mixture into your farm that has a range of disease resistance profiles.
You are wanting to say something.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Yeah, well, we've talked a lot about all the different aspects of IPM and the way people can adjust their programs. And Fiona's mentioned the, you know, cutting back on possibly fungicides which don't have a particularly strong impact on yield and disease control. But one thing we haven't said too much about is alternatives. And there's going to be a great deal of interest in this in the next 10 years. We know with the EU plan to cut fungicide use by significant amounts in the next 10 years, there's going to be a bigger emphasis on biologicals and other components which can fit into an IPM program, things like elicitors. There's things that we've been looking at as part of the Scottish Government funded work for the last 5 years and how they can be incorporated into a crop protection program. And we've seen consistently you can use elicitors at early points in crop growth, almost replacing fungicide input there, and then you can use your fungicides later on in the control program. So again, I think that's something that farmers and growers need to be abreast of, keep abreast of what's going on in the market and the field in terms of alternatives as well.
Neil, does this go hand in hand with, there's a lot of kind of renewed interest in the use of things like biostimulants now in a whole range of crops. And do you think that some of those in the future at least may have a role to play in disease management?
That's the $64 million question, Andy, because a lot of products that we see coming onto market now have claims of impact on disease control. And again, it's something that's going to need a lot of careful thought and looking at. And there's also a new registration scheme coming in the next 2 years where people who advertise these products are going to have to produce independent verified proof of these claims. So that's going to be quite interesting as well. But yeah, absolutely. There's a huge amount of interest in biostimulants and other crop additions as alternatives to fungicides.
Yes, just to add to that point on biostimulants. So because they have multiple effects, it's quite hard to separate out, you know, what's doing what. And, you know, a well-fed crop can be more resilient. But it is important to say that if a biostimulant makes a claim about a plant protection activity, it has to have been through the full plant protection screening. So for the most part, they don't make claims for that very reason, which is not to say they're not effective. It's just that our current legislative processes don't allow for that. So you can't claim a biostimulant as a plant protection product without proving it.
Robin, I was wanting to ask you a question about with your intercrops and so on, like say, for example, peas and spring barley, do you see any effect of the intercrop in terms of reduced diseases in either of the crops, whether it's peas or the barley?
Yeah, generally speaking, disease is much less of an issue in the intercrops than it is in the when they're grown as a sole crop, and that goes for both, you know, the grain legume and the cereal, which say for the most part is barley, apart from when we'd use the oats in the lentils. So yeah, the definitely that diversity within the kind of same area of ground does tend to lead to reduction in disease problems.
Sort of related to that, in terms of other agronomic inputs, because obviously there may be some restrictions on herbicides, for example, that you could use when you're growing, say, a legume and a cereal together. Do you see any agronomic benefits as well in terms of perhaps reducing other pesticide inputs?
Well, yes, for that very reason. One of the obvious things is, in terms of herbicides, there's a very, very restricted range that you can use without killing one or the other of the crops. But then you can actually use that to your advantage, because in some instances, particularly some of these participatory farms that we've talked about, who are, well, there's a mix of conventional and organic, but in terms of some of the conventional guys, they're actually growing mixtures starting off and either waiting, if it was an autumn crop, waiting for winter kill to knock out one of the species that they've put in there for a particular purpose or benefit. But in the spring, they will actually sometimes actively target one of the species with a herbicide to reduce it. So they're trying to use the system to develop the crop up to a certain point, but only really take one of them through to full harvest. So there's a mix. Depends what you're trying to do. But yeah, there's limitations, obviously, in what you can do if you wanted to grow the mix of crops right through to maturity. So weed control is an issue there, or can be an issue there, although they tend to be fairly competitive. So there's theoretically you can get away with a much lower herbicide program or no herbicide program at all. Or you can, as I say, you can go down the route of using whatever species you're growing as a one of them as a nurse crop, and then modify that with a targeted herbicide to knock out one or the other of the crops.
Fiona, you mentioned in your introduction about having input from New Zealand into the Arable Scotland event. Do you want to maybe say a bit more about what aspects might be covered in that?
Yes, so I think the New Zealand experience on cropping is always a good contrast to ourselves. So we've got Joe Drummond coming from the Foundation for Arable Research. And what's interesting about the New Zealand practice, they grow a huge diversity of alternative crops. So that in itself is interesting. And as a result, some of their soils, not say they don't have some of our issues with soil health, but they often sit on, you know, quite high residual fertility and have a broad range of alternative crops. Now, that in itself bring problems because, you know, you have some knowledge spread thinly over many crops and, you know, reduced numbers of active pesticides. So I'm really interested in their experience there. But specifically on their cereal crops, I mean, they've often suffered similar issues to us in terms of resistance, just a bit further behind. But they have been coping without chlorothalonil. And they've been doing that, you know, they've relied on SDHIs and have moved to a position where they're much more aware of the need to support and protect that chemistry. So growers really just over the last season have moved to trying to use that only once. The other thing is, they've now had a season's use of Inatrek commercially. So that's the new QII product. So I'm really interested in their experience there, where again they've seen it used to good effect where it's in mixed programs. So I think those are the kind of things that I'm interested in hearing what they've experienced. I don't want to preempt all of that in this podcast, but I think that contrasting experience and how they've managed to cope without, you know, what for us has been a major tool, chlorothalonil, are really key. And I think the other thing, I mean, their experience of alternative crops is great. Our traditional alternative crop has been oilseed rape, but we know we're over-reliant on that in our rotations, and we've built up issues with, you know, particularly the soil-borne problem, clubroot. So we're trying to think in more integrated ways about managing problems in oilseed rape as well. I'm not suggesting that we'll go as far as growing kiwi fruit and other such exotica, but I do think some of that transferable experience on, you know, managing better soil health and longer rotations is something that we could borrow from.
You wanted to add to that?
It was just a quick question for Fiona, really. You mentioned the value of multi-sites in a winter wheat program. I just wondered what multi-sites are available to growers at the moment.
Thanks, Henry. Yes, that's a good additional question. So the two that are available at the moment are Mancozeb and Folpit. So kind of interesting to compare them to the efficacy that we were used to in chlorothalonil, where we know from the fungicide performance work that broadly you could probably peg the activity of Folpet at about 50% of what we were used to with chlorothalonil. But you have to remember that chlorothalonil was really very effective compared to our other systemic chemistry. So that it carries additional cost, but it is still a useful level of efficacy in the wheat crops in particular. Mancozeb, broadly similar. I mean, they have pluses and minuses. We know mancozeb has some additional activity against ear blight, so that's interesting. I think the other key thing to mention about those products is that Folpet we can use up until flowering, so it's got a cutoff of 59. So that makes it tricky for inclusion at ear spray timings. Mancozeb products like Dithane you can use up to mid-flowering, so there's scope to include them there. But like I say, I think as part, we know that these multi-sites carry a lower risk of resistance development, and the concept that we maximise the use of our lowest risk options and minimise our use of high-risk chemistry, so I'm including single sites like the SDHIs in that. I think that concept that wherever possible we support our programmes with multi-sites is quite a sound one in wheat. But yes, those are the two multi-sites that we're talking about when, you know, we're talking about replacing chlorothalonil. It's mancozeb and Folpet.
I've just got a sort of question here about what's the mycotoxin risk, you think, for this season, seeing as we've had the very sort of humid, overcast weather, at least for in the middle of June?
So, I mean, it's an obligation if you're putting wheat into the supply chain that you have to conduct a mycotoxin risk assessment. And you're absolutely correct, Andy. The wetter the weather over flowering and over ear ripening are really key drivers. And Sod's Law, having had a very dry spring, that things will average out and we're moving into a wetter period. We're quite used to that. We do carry some mycotoxin risk in the north, so we know from research work carried out in Neil's team that many of the fusariums that are toxin-forming are present in Scotland. But that said, our weather risk is less. There is some varietal influence in that risk as well. And the really key piece is applying predominantly azole chemistry on the ear to reduce that risk of ear blight and beyond that, the risk of mycotoxins. We've historically used a lot of prothioconazole at that timing, which has enhanced efficacy against the fusarium species. So that's one of the key ways we moderate that risk. And probably important to say that, I mean, ear sprays may well be behind us at the moment, but it's important in a wet summer that goes on quite early in flowering to coincide with splash events, because once you move much beyond the infection event with fusarium, the efficacy of your chemistry drops significantly. But the mycotoxin risk assessment is on the HDB website, and it is important that that's acknowledged. On the barley crops, we don't directly target the ear with fungicides, and the yield responses in doing so are very small in the winter crop and non-existent in the spring crop. So again, targeting chemistry onto the ear of barley is one of the stages that are probably easiest left out in terms of managing ear blight diseases going forward. And the other thing is that sooty moulds can be very visual. They're, you know, not pleasant to look at, but they're often not very damaging. They're seldom damaging to yield, and they're often not that damaging to quality, because that, you know, the sooty outer will thrash off and leave the grain within unscathed. So they are, you know, a risk in a very wet summer, but probably not our major concern this year.
I just want to add, I mean, Fiona's covered a kind of control, but we've been doing some monitoring work in conjunction with the Rowett Institute on mycotoxins, and one of the things that's come through in the last 3 or 4 years is really that oats seem to be the crop where the major threat is coming from in terms of mycotoxin levels. So as Fiona points out, we're seeing a lot of the mycotoxin fusarium species in barley and wheat crops, but in terms of mycotoxin, detectable mycotoxin levels, oats seems to be a crop where there might be an issue. So that's something we've got to keep our eye on.
All right, well, thanks very much there. I think we've had a good old chat and a discussion there about topics which are going to be covered in a bit more detail in the Arable Scotland event. And I'd like to thank Neil Havis, Robin Walker, Henry Cryson and Fiona Burnett for joining me. And thank you very much for your participation.